Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's Byte.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Don't touch that dial. You're tuned in to the Dread Podcast Network.
Welcome to Development Hell. For every horror movie that hits VOD, countless others end up DOA. Development Hell is the podcast dedicated to unearthing these cursed horror productions. We're going to find out what went wrong, and then decide if these titles still stand a shot at the green light. I am your host, Josh Korngut. I am the managing editor of Dread Central. I am also a filmmaker in Toronto, Canada. This podcast is a proud member of the Dread Podcast Network. Hi, everybody, and welcome back to a brand new episode of Development Hell. Today, we're going to dive into a number of the unrealized versions of the Creature from the Black Lagoon, but we're here to actually focus on Guillermo del Toro's unique journey with this franchise and IP. Today, we are joined by a very special guest, Terry Menard of Gaily Dreadful fame. Terry, how's it going?
I'm doing really good, Josh. I'm excited to be here and chat about Guillermo del Toro and his journey.
Yeah, because he's got a big journey. In fact, his journey continued on today. We'll get into that a little bit later. I just want to know what's going on with you in your world, and like, what kind of stuff are you working on right now?
Geez, I'm real busy recently with like a lot of podcast recording because I'm also the co-host of Scarred for Life. And so that's kind of picking up steam recently with a lot of recordings. And then we're going to be, I don't know when this episode's dropping, but we're also going to be in San Francisco for the Unnamed Footage Festival. So I'm trying to get stuff prepped for that for when we're going to be gone. So it's a busy time.
So for people that maybe don't know, what is that festival all about? What's their deal?
Yeah, it's a found footage festival where I guess it focuses on found footage and screen life and pseudo documentary and anything that kind of falls within those umbrellas. And so there's a lot of really good indie found footage films. I know this year they have this, I'm using quotation marks, lost film from 2011 that was like a kind of a found footage survivor like movie.
Cool.
Like based on Survivor that they were trying to at the time sell as a real like reality TV show before, you know, it just vanished, and that's playing. So I'm really excited to see that. Yeah.
I'm excited for you guys to go to that festival. I'm going to be heading to the Overlook the week after. Yeah. I feel like has festival season begun already?
Oh, I know. I'm telling you, it's ridiculous. Like I had Sundance and then it was quiet for a bit. And now between like South By is popping up and Unnamed, and then we're going to get into Overlook, as well as Panic Fest is coming out in April.
Yeah.
And Salem. It's like everything's happening.
And don't even talk about the fall, because will we survive? And if we do, what will be left of us? Well, on today's very special episode of Development Hell, we're going to go down kind of a unique path. As I mentioned, we are talking about The Creature from the Black Lagoon and its many sort of unfinished, unrealized remakes. But we're also taking a bit of a route with Guillermo del Toro and talking about his unmade remake and how that turned into a very different movie that I'm really excited to talk about and will reveal, I guess, a little bit down the line. Terry, if it's okay with you, maybe I could start off by giving a brief seminar on The Creature from the Black Lagoon. This is a 1954 American classic horror movie, black and white, released in 3D, horror movie back from the day, and it was produced by William Allen and directed by Jack Arnold. You might have heard of it. It's one of the very classic Universal monster horror movies. This is the one with the Gill Man, the sort of swamp man, and it starred Richard Carlson, Julia Adams, Richard Denning, and Whit Bissell. So this is a movie about a group of scientists who have decided very sort of unfortunately to go down to the Amazon, and this is where they encounter a humanoid amphibious creature deep in the rivers down there. They know him as the creature, but sort of, I think, through the zeitgeist, we're sort of getting to know him as the Gill Man. This guy was played by Ben Chapman when he was in the rubber suit on the land, but underwater was portrayed by a different performer, Raquel Browning.
You know what's interesting, though? So the person that created the initial suit or the design for it was a woman. And her story was not, she was wiped clean from having anything to do with it. Like her cohort who was male took all the credit and she sort of vanished from Hollywood. But there is this really interesting book out there by Mallory O'Meara called The Lady from the Black Lagoon, Hollywood Monsters and the Lost Legacy of Millicent Patrick, who was the woman that created the suit initially. And it's a really good book. So I think if for fans that are interested in the creature, they should go check that out.
Well, I guess we're still doing this to women in the industry, but back then it was really rough, just like complete erasure. Yeah, this production was filmed in 3D and originally projected by the polarized light method. In 1975, it was released into theaters yet again with the classic red and blue sunglasses and was finally dumped on home video in 1980 on both VHS and Beta. Now, this is something I didn't know, probably should have known, that there were two sequels to this. Was this something you were familiar with before today?
Oh, yeah. See, I was raised on Universal monster movies. My dad was a huge fan. And so that was my actual introduction to the genre was through Dracula, Frankenstein, all of those, but also Creature from the Black Lagoon. And funnily enough, my first encounter with this movie was a VHS that my dad had rented that ended up being the 3D version and we didn't have glasses for it.
Okay.
And I think we watched for like 20 minutes and then just gave up because it was like red and the red and blue lines, you know?
Oh yeah. It had texture to it.
Sure did.
I mean, that's hilarious. Yeah, I have yet to see these sequels. I'd love to. There was Revenge of the Creature in 1955, which I think was just a year later. And then there was The Creature Walks Among Us in 1956, and I think that one was from a different director. Do you have memories of these? Like, do you remember how you felt about the sequels?
I remember seeing them, and that's about it. I honestly do not remember them at all.
Well, my first question for you, which you kind of touched on, is like, so yeah, when did you first encounter these movies? How old were you when you were introduced to this franchise and to this whole world?
Oh, boy. I must have been about 7 or 8, I think, when I saw the first movie for the first time. Mm-hmm. And like I said, I was a huge, huge fan of like the Universal Monsters. So I had gone through all of them. And then what I honestly remember is the way that this character was utilized after then, particularly in like Monster Squad. Mm-hmm. I was always like a big fan of Gill Man or the creature. And so, yeah, I just growing up, this was a repeat for me. This was a big one for me.
Since you were like so involved with these movies growing up, I'm wondering like how did the creature rank among the monsters for you and your dad?
So I think for both of us, it was actually kind of low when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. Because my dad was more drawn to like Dracula and I was more drawn to the Wolfman and also Abbott and Costello's version when they met Frankenstein in one of their movies and it had like all the monsters in it. Mm-hmm. That was like the one that I would continually return to as a kid. So it was more of the horror comedy route. But yeah, this one as a kid ranked a little lower for me, but as an adult, it's easily my favorite.
That's so interesting because I've visited, I think, most of the classic Universal monsters, but this is one I've never made time for. And I'm wondering, do you think that's common? Like, do you think in the zeitgeist of horror and classic horror that the Gill Man is kind of like at the bottom of the ladder, that he kind of gets the shaft?
I actually do, because I think it was more towards the tail end of when the Universal was having its run. And so Creature was in the 1950s, whereas mm-hmm. like Dracula and them were decades earlier. Mm-hmm. And so I do feel that, you know, by the time that was getting introduced, people were moving on to different things than the Universal monster area. So I do think that it probably was not as appreciated as much as some of the earlier ones.
Mm-hmm.
Although it's a much better film than most of those original ones, if I'm being perfectly honest. Like, the filmmaking behind it is top notch.
Well, I was thinking that too. I saw it for the first time last night, and it's really beautiful, especially those underwater sequences where, you know, this must have been, you know, complicated technology now, with there must have been giant pools that they were shooting this in. Really beautiful techniques underwater, and it was like really something to watch. How was it on this revisit for you? Did it hold up?
Oh, it exceeded my memories, because it's been a long time since I've revisited a lot of the Universal monsters, in particular this one. So yeah, when I was watching it, I was astounded by the cinematography, particularly underwater, just the way it looked and the way I was thinking about the performances, because the guy that played Gilman was having to hold his breath for 2 to 4 minutes at a time. And it's just, you see that and you see what they're managing to create here. It's really spectacular for the time.
It's really beautiful. And it starts off with some pretty cerebral storytelling, where they start off at like the beginning of the formation of the planet, and they do it with some, I don't know, like very interesting techniques. Kind of I don't know if it's experimental, but it feels experimental when you watch it.
It's also an interesting start, because it kind of takes on a Christian mythology to it, but also science, because it's like the Big Bang and billions of years and, you know, evolution and all that stuff. But then there's also like God created heaven and earth. Like, so it's like this combination of religion and science that I was surprised to see, honestly.
Well, then did God create the creature, you know, like, was this on purpose? Was this a big accident? You have to wonder how he played into the whole thing. Do you think it's scary? Like, I know that it's a very different time to watch something like this, but can you imagine why this would have frightened people back in the 1950s?
Absolutely. I do think now watching it, the music is a little too bombastic for me. There's like a refrain that continually happens whenever the creature is about to attack or does attack. And it just got it's a little excessive for me as an adult. But yeah, I can absolutely see how this movie would terrify people. There's the first shot of the hand coming out of the lagoon reaching, and just the kind of, it looks really good. It's a man in a suit, but it looks really good. And particularly for the 1950s, I would say that would absolutely be, I think it would be terrifying if I had saw this in movie theater as a kid.
I think so too. And there was some Guillermo del Toro quote that I came across, but can't recall exactly what he was saying, but it was all about that hand. There is something really frightening about the slow sort of very on purpose sort of steadiness of that hand coming out of the water. And for the first few attacks in the film, you basically only see the hand. You see the hand sort of attacking people in the head or in the face, which is a little silly, but you can imagine that really messed with people back in 1954.
Well, it's the same thing that Steven Spielberg would use like 20 years later with Jaws, where it's like you don't really see what's happening until later on in the movie. You just see like quick shots of it.
Yeah.
And so I think that sort of not really giving you all of it allows your imagination to play with it. You see this army, like what the heck is that attached to? And so I do think that this movie plays at that really well.
Yeah, there's some, I like that you brought up Jaws, because there's some of those very tense scenes where I think she is getting out of the water, and you're just like, is she going to grab her foot? No, but you're like, you're on edge, worried about it the whole time.
And absolutely.
It's tense.
Very intense. And I was actually thinking as I was watching this that Jaws is indebted to this film. We get like the shot of her underwater where it's like almost the shark POV from Jaws. We get moments like that where there's focus on when the ship's trying to escape at one point and there's branches down. You know, there's the shot of like the winch that's breaking. And I'm like, okay, that's like the shark cage. Like, there's a lot of like one for one shots that I think Steven Spielberg probably referenced when he was making this movie.
Can I share with you one of my family stories that kind of reminded me of one of these moments earlier on?
Please do.
So my grandmother used to tell me the story when I was little. She was Indonesian and was raised on a tea plantation in Indonesia, which is on a river. And she told me the story like multiple times about one day her sister was on a riverboat and there was someone in a smaller boat next to her, sort of paddling along next to the larger boat. And it was staring at her. And she was like a young, beautiful woman. And I guess she was uncomfortable with being stared at. And she looked at the man and was like, "What are you looking at?" Like very dismissive, kind of rude. And her feet were over the edge. And he said something along the lines of, "Oh, I was just watching your feet because I forget what animal. There was like a crocodile, alligator, something large, like right underneath."
Oh, my.
And she almost lost her toesies. And I think about that a lot. And this reminded me of that.
Yeah, I started realizing recently as I've been watching TikToks that I have a fear of deep, dark water. And
okay.
So I think the idea of like you don't really know what's lurking just below that like surface mm-hmm. level is really creepy, particularly for specific people.
Now, because it's a film from the 1950s, there's going to be aspects of it that don't hold up. And there was definitely some racism that might be worth noting, and even like an accidental reflection on environmentalism. Is that something that you sort of also caught watching it? I don't think it was the point back then, but it's hard to ignore it on watching it now.
Yeah, absolutely. The fact that we have people of color being utilized in the way that they are,
yeah,
and they're the ones that mostly get killed
right away.
It is definitely does not really pass that test about, like black people or dark people or people of color getting killed and the white people living. Like this definitely does not pass that idea, although it is very, I would say it does touch on environmentalism in ways I was not expecting this movie, a movie from the 1950s to do.
Like how?
Well, just the idea of this serene place, this creature, and yes, he's portrayed as like, to them, evil, but he is just living, he's minding his own business, and it is like the riverbed of civilization, and we are encroaching on it, and we want to take this creature and either kill it or take it back and study it and tear it apart. And so I think there is a slight critique of the way in which we kind of tear through nature that is here.
Well, they say pretty directly, like, if you look out at this river, this is exactly how it was, 500, 600 years ago. And, by placing like a bunch of white colonizers down there and with, their weapons, and they're going to come back and make a mess of the whole place, and there's something there that kind of leaves an icky feeling.
I also was thinking that the scientist that finds the fossilized hand is not a very good scientist because he just cuts it off. And I'm like,
I was thinking
no.
that too. I was like, oh my god,
you're supposed to chip around that thing, sir.
He's like, you're really fucked up, and you're not. Were you even using gloves?
No, he's just like manhandling it. I'm just like, are you kidding me?
I was so sure, because I'd never seen it before, that was like the future, and that like that hand was like going to be like the dead creature, and then we're going to like go and find out what happened to him. But no, it's just his friend, I guess.
Just his friend.
He's probably pissed that he broke his friend's hand off.
I mean, I would be.
I'd be mad. Also, what happened to your friend? And are there more friends? Probably. Maybe the sequels tackle all that.
I don't remember them tackling all that, but maybe.
Maybe they do. I couldn't say. So something that I've definitely am fascinated with based on, the conceit of this podcast are all of the unmade follow-ups. And basically, we've never received one, even though there was like a good 10 of them in production since the 1980s. I'd like to touch base on a few of them before we head into the land of Guillermo del Toro. And I was wondering if you would want to help me out with sort of giving a brief seminar on the first couple of failed reboots in the works.
Yeah, sure. I know that in 1982, John Landis was basically campaigning for Jack Arnold of the original film to do a remake, which mm-hmm. I thought would be kind of cool. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, this would have been really interesting to see in the 80s, just because, you know, that was the kind of the time where a lot of 50s movies were remade.
Yep.
And they did really good job with them, from The Blob, The Fly, and The Thing. It would be interesting to see, although I think they might kind of ruin what this thing was going for with 80s excess, probably. But
yeah, probably.
But yeah, I know that was like the first attempt.
Wait, before we move on, can I just tell you what my, you know, we all have favorite decades?
Yeah.
You know what my favorite decade is?
What's that?
My favorite decade is the 1950s as presented by the 1980s.
Oh, okay. So, you know,
like Grease, or like, they just like don't totally, oh, I know that might have been the 70s, but they don't totally get it right. But there's something about it that I find, I don't know, very comforting.
It's nostalgia porn.
Oh, yeah. Big time. Like layers on layers.
Layers on layers on layers.
On layers. Okay, interesting. Onion. So they wanted the original director back. I'm okay with that.
Yeah, it would have been interesting to see. So I know that the script was written by Nigel Neal. I believe that's how you pronounce his last name. Mm-hmm. And he wrote the original script for Halloween 3. I don't think it's the one, correct me if I'm wrong, the one that went into production. But then he was removed from production after Dino De Laurentiis had the final cut of the film, and he wanted it to be much more violent and action-packed. Which, again, 80s excess, that makes sense, right?
Mm-hmm.
And his script involved two creatures, one that was destructive and the other calm. And I don't know, it would have been interesting to see, but I'm actually kind of glad this one did not get made when I start thinking about what they probably wanted to do with it.
I just don't think bringing in the original guy from the 1950s was going to, I don't know, I guess the obvious answer is, like, do something fresh. Mm-hmm. I think it needed something. It needed sort of like a new take, and I'm not sure if that old, presumably white guy would have had it in him.
Yeah, that's true.
But I guess all the directors in the 1980s were also old white guys, but they were less old at the time.
True.
Okay, interesting, interesting. Why don't you give us the next one in line?
Sure. So then 10 years later, John Carpenter was involved.
Oh.
And that would have been interesting. I know that effects wizard Rick Baker was hired to create the early 3D sculpts for the project, and that would have been interesting. John Carpenter in the 1920s, that would have been like...
I would have been very fascinated with that. Yeah. I often get this franchise mixed up with the Swamp Thing universe. And I also sometimes get Wes Craven's, like, lesser titles get mixed up with John Carpenter's lesser titles. So I definitely would have been interested to see how, like, a John Carpenter 1992 Black Lagoon movie would hold up against something like Swamp Thing. Interesting.
Huh.
Would you have wanted this from John Carpenter? Would you have wanted to see his version of this?
I mean, look, I like some of John Carpenter's movies, uh-huh. but as his career went on, I think he had more misses than hits.
And of course, he tackled another amazing, like, another classic 50s horror movie with The Thing and turned that on its head and created something really phenomenal. But what was that, like the really early 80s, or at least in the 80s? And this was, you know, in a different era for John.
Yeah, but it would have been interesting because, I mean, this movie would have come out the same time as Wes Craven's People Under the Stairs, so that'd be interesting to see.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know that someone else of rather like large note was next on the chopping block.
Oh,
you
yeah.
Tell us about that.
Peter Jackson.
Damn.
In 1995.
Shit.
And he wanted to develop King Kong instead. And I mean,
he did.
He it took him another, did.
What, another 10 years?
Yeah.
To do it?
Yeah, I think so.
Wow, I guess they were really preparing to give him the world well before Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, I'm trying to think, because at that time in 1985,
it was only those like little splatter movies that I'm
right. That's what I was
no,
thinking.
No, there was Heavenly Creatures.
Did that come out in 95?
I think that was, if I had to guess, I would say 94.
Okay.
But that's a guess. So should we look into that? Should we just...
I'm pulling it up. Right okay, now. Okay.
I have to say, usually I'm pretty good at guessing your yeah, years.
Ah, 94.
Fuck yeah.
Look at you.
I'm a year psychic, just so you know. Just so you know.
Wow.
And I don't actually know the info. which would be more impressive. Okay, so this was right after Heavenly Creatures. They wanted him to do Black Lagoon. Interesting. I mean, he could have, this guy could have pulled it off for
true. Sure. But the team, the writing team behind it, I don't know. Space Jam.
Oh no.
Trading Places.
No.
Twins and Kindergarten Cop.
So the people that brought us Space Jam and then Peter Jackson and then Creature from the Black Lagoon, tell me you wouldn't want to see that in theaters. It's not going to be good, but you want to see it.
Oh, this was totally a horror comedy based on this.
I think, I hope so. I don't know for sure, though. But I'm definitely fascinated. I think this was around the same time that he was developing this was a few years after he was developing a Freddy Krueger movie. Because he was going to do the sixth entry, which was pretty cool sounding. And then they went with something. Are you familiar with all the Nightmare movies? Sorry. I can't just assume
anymore. I'm a Fredhead for life.
Okay, me too. Okay, well then you know that part six is rough stuff.
It's something else. It's a
so bad.
Freddy meets Looney Tunes.
And like, I'll definitely watch it about 40 more times before I die, but it's horrendous.
Oh, it's horrendous, but it's not as bad as five.
Oh, see, I disagree. I disagree. I think five is misunderstood. It's underrated. I kind of like, it's a part of that middle trilogy. It's still creative in a way that six kind of lost that magic. Like some of the kills are still like bonkers, crazy town, banana pants. And I feel
they
like
are.
Actually six still has a couple of those. So what am I saying? Wow, you prefer six to five. Very interesting.
No, I mean,
you have to note it down.
This is like very low, very, very low. Like there's a gulf of distance between those movies and the rest of the franchise for me.
Okay, if someone was like, you have to pick right now, we're either going to be putting on part six or the remake.
Part six.
I think I'd pick the remake only because I've only seen it like once or twice. So I do want to revisit it to see what's going on.
It's horrible.
Yeah, I remember it being bad.
It's boring. And I'm sorry, if you're going to like, if you're going to take iconic moments from the original one, which I'm happy with you doing, you got to at least meet, if not exceed, those moments. And the iconic Tina death is not iconic in the remake. And I'm like, no, all I'm going to be doing is sitting here comparing this to the original, which is a perfect movie.
Okay, but you know what they do beat the original on? Mm-hmm. The Connie Britton death. Which, if you...
She's pulled through the mirror, right?
Yeah, which is better than the cardboard box getting pulled through the window. You have to give it that.
Do I, though?
And Connie Britton. I prefer there's no cardboard one six box. Year. I love her.
She's great.
Ugh. And then Rooney Mara just being like, I hate Nightmare on Elm Street. And I was like, stop. You don't respect it. You need to leave my house.
But it has Kyle Gallner in it.
I know. What a cutie.
He is.
Like, the cast is actually pretty good. Like, the cast is, like, a talented group of people.
Oh, it should have been good.
It should have been good, yeah. It wasn't, though. Where's Freddy at, huh? Where is she now?
Hiding with the Creature from the Black Lagoon.
They're just making out.
Ooh.
I'm okay with it. They're both hot in their own different ways.
Give me that movie.
Mm-hmm. Like, who would you hire for Freddy?
For Freddy?
Yeah. Not the actor, for the, like, who you'd hire to make it.
Yeah. I mean, I would have to go with some, like, I honestly, an indie director that, like...
Whoa. Not indie. No, I'm kidding. Yeah, probably. That's probably the way to go.
Like, I think that they need to go back to the original, go back to making a scrappy little horror movie.
You know who I'd hire?
Hmm.
Oh, God, what was his name? Ronnie Yu.
Oh, my God.
Bring back the you, okay?
Didn't he do Freddy versus Jason?
Yes, what do you mean, didn't he? Of course. And Bride of Chucky, the two
and Bride most of Chucky.
Influential, important horror films, I think, of all time.
Oh, that's a take.
Would you be okay if I maybe dug up a little bit of the info on the unmade Guillermo del Toro version of events?
Yes, please.
So Next in Line, which I believe was 2002, IGN, our friends over there, reported that, yes, best friend, BFF forever, Guillermo del Toro was officially attached to this remake. But I think that our friend over there, who just won an Oscar today, and we're very pleased to hear it, had a very different vision of what he wanted to see than the studio had in mind. He mentioned that he wanted to see it a little bit more from the creature's point of view. And more interestingly, he wanted the romantic relationship between the woman and the creature to be a little bit more fruitful, a little bit more successful, I guess. And the studio said, who are you? What are you talking about? You are immediately fired. And so they let him go. And then they hired some Hollywood hack named Teddy Serafian. Does that sound
right?
Yeah,
that sounds right.
That's the best we're going to get. Who wrote, are you ready, Terminator 3, Rise of the Machines, to write the script in 2003. And thank God that never happened. Oh. But yeah, so it never happened. And we just gave you guys a taste of a few of the many, many failed reincarnations of this film. And I think from here, we're going to sort of talk a little bit more about Guillermo del Toro and his relationship with the creature from the Black Lagoon, because he didn't really give up and he would go on to make a movie that was his version of this trope or these stories. So Guillermo del Toro, Terry.
Yes.
Are you a fan? What's your relationship with GDT?
Love him, would wage a war with him.
Oh, me too.
For him.
Me too. I would kill for him. I would.
I would help him hide the body even.
For sure. I love him so much. He really can't do anything wrong. My favorite movie from 2021 was Nightmare Alley, and I don't think anyone else feels that way. I fucking loved it so much.
Did you? I did too.
Did you? I feel like I'm so... Okay, thank you. I'm love to hear that because I don't hear it enough.
It's a very... So I one of the critiques that I have heard is that people were talking about how Guillermo del Toro is a little too romantic to do a noir. And while I kind of get where they're coming from, I don't find anything really romantic about that movie. In fact, I find it very dark. And I think there's like a warmth to the filmmaking behind it, but I think the story itself is just upsetting.
Yeah, it's completely brutal. There's no light at the end of the tunnel, and it works.
I think it works really well.
And it's just so beautiful, too. Everything he does is just like a spectacle, and I just want more of it when it's done. And I think that movie kind of got the shaft. I think it was underrated. And also because of when it got released, I think it was just when Omicron hit. So it was a big financial bust, which is just too bad. Do you have a favorite Guillermo del Toro movie or movies?
Yeah, Pan's Labyrinth.
Oh, well, that's such a good one. Do you remember like what your first encounter with that movie was like?
Absolutely, I do. I remember... So I'm at the time, because like, you know, he was known for Mimic... and Blade 2 and Hellboy. Those are the ones that I knew, the more Hollywood version of it. And I remember seeing those and being like, okay, these are okay. I don't see what everyone is like gaga for with this guy. And then I remember Pan's Labyrinth started getting a lot of press and a lot of awards buzz. And so I went to go see it in the movie theaters when it came out. And I remember just sitting there and being transported to this other world that was scary and romantic and deeply depressing, and I vividly remember just bawling in the movie theater when the movie was over. It affected me so much.
Mm-hmm. I mean, listen, I rewatched The Shape of Water today, and within the first 10 minutes I was blubbering, and I don't know why, because it's not particularly sad in those first few minutes, but there's just something about how he tells a story, how he frames characters, specifically how he frames like ladies on screen, that really like gets to me immediately. And I guess I think the same for you. Horror is everything to me. Like, it's my number one passion in this world. And he has a way of getting into horror the exact way that is my preference, which is through a little bit of fantasy, a little bit through like the eyes of a child, a little bit through like the fantastic element. I know that he's a huge fan of Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, like the original mm-hmm. book series. And you can tell that he's a Scary Stories boy. Like, you can feel that in everything that he does. And I just really, I think I, like, I just relate to his tastes so much, like more than any other filmmaker. And so it feels really personal for me with these movies.
His movies kind of bring me back to that childhood wonder.
Yeah.
And I think it's because he has a obvious love of fairy tales. And so all of his movies, I think most of, if not all of his movies, are there's a fairy tale quality to it. Mm-hmm. And I think that maybe that, but I don't see that in Nightmare Alley. Maybe that's why it didn't strike the chord with a lot of people. But like every other movie of his comes across as almost like a fairy tale. And so it brings you back to that kind of being a kid reading Grimm's fairy tales or mm-hmm. whatever fairy tales you were reading at the time. And that sort of sense of wonder that would come with it. So I do think that he is able to kind of tap into that childhood fear, childhood wonder, childhood joy and awe. Just, he can't be beat.
He can't be beat. It's really, really magical. I'm also a big fan of the Hellboy movies, which is not exactly my usual cup of tea. But the way that they sort of balance like the fun comic book world, but also like Lovecraftian horror at the same time is just, it's like, you're not seeing anything like this anywhere else. And yeah, it's always like a treat when he makes a film. Did you see Pinocchio?
I have actually not seen Pinocchio yet.
I liked it. It definitely carries in that sense of like childhood horror a little bit in like a more wholesome way. Like there are a couple of characters that are kind of terrifying even though they're good. You know, the whole concept of like scary angels, I feel like he does that really well.
I could see that. Yeah, absolutely.
So this fella, ever since he was a kid, was a big fan of Creature from the Black Lagoon, and I think really wanted to make a version that was true to him. And even though the 2002 film kind of fell apart, he wasn't going to let that stop him. And by 2017, he delivered The Shape of Water. And according to Variety, and this was back in 2018, he got the idea for the film when he was at the age of 6. And he saw the 1954 Creature from the Black Lagoon with all the underwater shots of the gill man reaching out for Julia as she was swimming around. And he thought it was really romantic and exciting. And as a 6-year-old, he really assumed that the two of them were going to end up together. And he was actually shocked when it ended the way that it ends, which, spoiler alert, like, they kill him. Like, it does not end happily for the Gillman.
It sure does not.
It doesn't. And he said, wow, like, I wish they would have ended up together. And then on quote, he said, I decided I would someday have to correct that, which I think is really beautiful. We were talking about how romantic his works are, and this one is romantic in like all of the literal ways, and it like makes me really emotional. Terry, would you be comfortable maybe delivering a bit of a brief seminar on The Shape of Water?
I sure can try. Let me get out my glasses and okay. Yeah, so The Shape of Water is from 2017. It's a romantic fantasy film. Guillermo del Toro directed, of course, written by Del Toro and Vanessa Taylor. Mm-hmm. It stars Sally Hawkins, an incredibly creepy yet somewhat campy Michael Shannon, Richard Jenkins playing a gay guy that I love, Doug mm-hmm. Jones is the titular creature, Michael Stuhlbarg, which I always forget he's in this movie until I start watching.
Wait, and Octavius.
I think he was
the Russian?
Yeah. Oh. What's his name? Why can't I think of what his name is?
Doctor. Yeah.
Dr. Hofstetter Stettler. Yeah.
And he's in such a Halloween costume that it's kind of hard to recognize.
Yeah.
Okay, and then I interrupt you before you said the last name.
Octavia Spencer.
Hell yeah.
Who I love.
Me too.
She's queen. Mm-hmm. She has a really fun cameo in 30 Rock. One episode really
what is it
she So Tracy Jordan gets into directing towards the end of the show, okay. I think in season 6 maybe, or season 7 actually. And he wants to do a story about Harriet Tubman, and so he hires Octavia Spencer to be to play Harriet Tubman. And she turns out to be basically a walking Tracy, doing everything that Tracy would do, just like leaving with her like posse and being a complete ass. Everything that Tracy was doing, she was doing back then. It was really funny. But
did she play herself, or is she just playing? Oh my god!
No, she plays herself playing Harriet Tubman.
She is makes a very small. I have to make sure it's actually her. Yes, it is her. Okay, do you know which Halloween movie she's in?
She was in a Halloween movie.
Can you guess what Halloween movie Octavia Spencer is in?
No. Which one? I can't.
She is in Rob Zombie's Halloween 2. She plays a nurse that gets terribly murdered.
Okay, I have not seen that one.
You haven't seen Rob Zombie's Halloween 2?
No, because I hated the first one.
Oh, it's horrible. But I'm sure you've heard the internet pretend that they like the second one more.
People do say they like the second one
more. They say it. I actually personally think I like the second one more too, but like, it's like saying I like something more than...
I like the flies on the shit more than
yeah, it's like, okay. I guess that's true. It's like, I hate beets, so like, I like, you know, mashed potatoes more than beets, but I don't love mashed potatoes.
You don't love mashed potatoes?
I do. It's a horrible, horrible, horrible example, because I fucking love mashed potatoes. But I thought maybe people would, like, just go with it, because they're kind of gross.
Sorry, I ruined the...
Like, I thought I could get away with it, because I couldn't think of anything else. I do find mashed potatoes and beets often are in the same meal. Is that true for you? It is in my family.
I don't actually think I've ever had a beet.
Oh, really? And maybe it's like a Eastern European Jewish thing. But like, you have schnitzel, you have mashed potatoes, and you have beets. And they're like, eat it. And I'm like, oh, God, I can't. I won't do it. Wait, okay. So where were we? So Octavia Spencer's in this. Love to see it. What did you think of her performance in this film?
I thought she was good. It kind of was channeling like The Help maybe a little bit. So like, I don't know, but I thought she was fun. Yeah. I didn't think it really gave her that whole lot to do.
So for people that maybe don't remember, what was The Shape of Water about?
Oh yeah. So set in 1962 in Baltimore, Maryland, it follows a mute custodian. That's one played by Sally Hawkins at a high security laboratory. And they have captured the humanoid amphibian creature, not the Gill Man. Although, really, this could be a sequel to Creature from the Black Lagoon in an alternate universe where Mark and Dave end up kissing and then taking the creature with them.
They kissed, for sure.
Absolutely. Sorry. That tent. They're just
who's the top, though?
Oh, I think...
Is it the blonde?
The blonde is Mark, right? And he's the guy in charge. I think Mark's in charge.
Okay.
I think he'd be a bossy bottom.
Yeah, for sure. 100%. He just had that kind of rude energy.
Yeah.
The men in that movie, sorry to like interrupt, but were so naked.
Oh, they were wearing the shortest shorts possible, and they were shirtless. Shorts.
The whole time. And I was like, I guess people didn't care that men were naked. I guess
it looked virile.
That's a perfect word for it. So interesting how you can have like nude male sexuality, but like the lady bathing suit was like a snow jacket. It was huge.
But
the boobs were pointy, so that's something. Right?
Yeah, love pointy blue boobs.
They were boobs. Okay. Okay, cool.
Yeah, so Sally Hawkins's Elisa falls in love with the amphibian creature and decides to help him escape. This movie was filmed in Ontario, Canada, from August to November of 2016.
Sweet.
And then it was screened as part of the main competition at the Venice International Film Festival in August of 2017. Mm. It was awarded the Golden Lion, and then it screened at TIFF.
Sick.
And then, you know, it was playing in limited release in two theaters in New York City. Mm-hmm. And I remember when that was happening, and I just like, come to Nebraska, I want to see this movie. And it took forever for it to finally get to me.
Oh, it didn't, because it went in wide release, right?
It did.
But
not right away. Yeah, so it was like, I mean, because you'd hear about this movie from Venice and then, you know, TIFF, and then it was like in New York at the beginning of December. And by that time, I'm just like, I want this movie now. And it was almost a month later, I think, like right before Christmas when it opened wide.
I never got to say what my favorite grandma movies are. It may be a tie between Shape of Water and Nightmare Alley. There's something about these later year period pieces by him that are just, I don't know, so fucking good.
Huh. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, he has such a fabulous career, though. Like, it's hard. It's hard to pick at most any of his movies, except Blade 2. I'm sorry. I know people.
What? You canceled. She's canceled. I can't. You're canceled. I can't. What? You hate Blade 2? Where did that come from? That was so violent and hateful.
The CG in it is just so horrible.
Yeah, it's not good CG, but it's just such a fun movie. Fair enough. It's funny, for a man that is such a king of genre and king of horror, he's really not delivered very many horror movies.
No.
Like, is there, like, what, two proper, maybe three proper horror movies? Because there's The Devil's Backbone.
Right.
There's Crimson Peak, which is arguable. And then there's Blade 2, which is arguable.
Is that it? Like, okay, I personally will say Pan's Labyrinth is a horror movie. I know people will fight me on that one. No, but I say it's a horror movie.
Listen, I'm one of those people that anything can be horror. I'm with you on that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's not a horror movie.
It is a horror movie.
Oh, yeah, you're right. I can't say that it's not. No. I'm being a silly girl. But, like, there's truly only one, like pure baseline, like, no other subgenre. It's a horror movie from this guy who is perceived to be kind of king of the genre.
Yeah. Yeah. So. I would have loved to have seen him get involved with the Silent Hill video game he was going to be working
on. God, we've done a full episode on that. It's, I think our only video game episode was on that fucking game, which is the most horrible cancel thing that they could have ever done. So, and then they took it off of the network too, so you can't even play it anymore.
I know.
Is it back? Did I hear that? Like, no. Okay,
it's not.
It is maybe the scariest game I've ever played. We're talking about PT, the playable trailer for Silent Hills, the Guillermo del Toro unmade sequel. And I once called it Guillermo del Toro's Silent Hills, and I've never had the audience be so mad at me because it's not his. It's Hideo
Kojima.
Yeah, it's his. He's first and foremost. So I know that now, okay? I've always known, but I will respect that now. Do you remember the trailer? There was no game footage in it, but it was just like the most fucked up, like nasty, insane trailer for the game that they released back in the day.
Yeah, I do. And I was like, I want this so bad.
Why? And well, we're getting new Silent Hill and they look good.
Yeah, we'll see.
I know. Which of the new, so have you seen the trailers for all of the new Silent Hills?
Yes, I don't really remember.
That's fair. There's so many now. So,
but because they were getting a remake for Silent Hill 2, yeah. We're getting the one that takes place in Japan.
Yeah, Forte or something. Yeah, Silent Hill F. And then there's one more, which is the one that I'm the most interested in, which is called Silent Hill Townfall, which I think it's by like Annapurna. Like,
they do good games.
They do. And they make my favorite kind of games, which are like not real games. It's just like it's basically a movie, but it's a game when you just like click and walk around and weird shit happens.
Yeah.
And it's truly my favorite kind of game. So I'm excited for that one the most. Are you a big game buff?
Oh, I'm a huge game buff.
Okay. My favorite game of all time, and I have a hard time finding people to connect with me on it, is What Remains of Edith Finch.
That's a good game.
Oh, thank god it's one of those things people never can connect with me on. I love that game so much. I played it right in the height of lockdown.
Oh, okay.
And so now I have really imprinted on it. So,
yeah. I mean I really enjoyed that game. My favorite game, if you were to ask me, of all time is Bloodborne.
Okay. I don't know much about it. Tell me more.
Have you ever played any of the FromSoft games?
No. Maybe.
Okay. I don't think so. Dark Souls?
Yes, and it was so hard. What the fuck?
So this is like Dark Souls, except that instead of blocking, you do a lot of dodging, and you're basically hunting monsters in a fantastical take on like Victorian England.
Cool.
Called Yharnam, and it's cosmic horror. There is giant evil gods that have been buried under the ground from falling from the sky. There is, they take the blood of them to do healing that ends up turning people into beasts. It's like nice. Bringing in Universal monster movies. It's bringing in Lovecraftian eldritch gods. It's bringing in everything I love, gothic. It's just, it's great. And then it's really, really fucking hard.
Cool. Okay, maybe I'll find that. I wonder, this is maybe the gayest thing I'll say today. I wonder if it's on Switch.
It's not. It's a PlayStation only game.
Why is there nothing on Switch? It's the only thing I want to play stuff on. Interesting. Okay, can I tell you what my actual favorite video game is of all time?
Yeah, please do.
American McGee's Alice is my favorite video game of all time. And it's actually why I started this podcast. Sorry, everyone at home. You've heard this so many times. But yeah, I was obsessed with, they were going to make a film. Wes Craven was going to direct a film. And it was like a scary version of Alice in Wonderland. And then Sarah Michelle Gellar got involved. And my little grade 8 brain was like, I can't wait. And then it never happened.
Yep.
And I guess I didn't realize back then that like more movies don't get made than actually get made. And my obsession with Development Hell kind of spawned from there.
Yeah, I could see that.
So back to The Shape of Water. How do you feel about this being like this new vision of the creature? Does this feel like it could be canon for The Creature from the Black Lagoon? Does it feel like a totally different thing? Like, where does it line up in the legacy of The Creature of the Black Lagoon?
I personally think that this is what would happen if, you know, David and what's his butt? I can't think of what his name is off the top of my head.
The Creature?
No, Mark. Mark and David.
Oh, of course. Sorry.
Capture Gilman and bring him back. Because there, I think Michael Shannon's character, I think, is a really good stand-in for either one of those characters,
to be
perfectly honest. And the way that there's a little bit of internalized homophobia there. There's a lot of toxic masculinity going on there. Mm-hmm. So I honestly think that this could have been like in a different world where The Creature from the Black Lagoon ended differently, this would be canon for sure.
He's like a realistic version of what those men are for real.
Yeah, absolutely.
Wait, what made you call him? I mean, I agree, but what made you describe him as campy?
I don't think it's intentional, but there is the moments where he is at home and he is with his family contrasted with what he is like outside of it, and then you get like the fingers that are turning rotten, and he's sitting there smelling his fingers. There's an obsession with smelling fingers in this. His wife does it earlier, and then he's sitting there smelling his rotting finger. There's like, I don't know, there's just a little bit element of that kind of campiness to that performance, and he gets really twirling mustache villainy by the end of it.
Okay, so those are good reasonings for the campiness. How do you think this film handled its queerness?
I think this movie understands outcasts so incredibly well, and the people that are marginalized by society. My heart broke for poor Richard Jenkins's character.
My god, me too.
When he goes to this pie place that he keeps ordering these horrible key lime pie that look like Jell-O. Like, I don't know what is going on there, but it does not look like a key lime pie. And his fridge is filling up with them just because he wants to keep going back to this guy that he's attracted to, who turns out to be a homophobic racist.
Yeah, it's really sad. Like, really sad.
It breaks my heart.
It made me feel really single, honestly, on this watch. It really, the sadness of this film really got to me, and it was really beautiful, but like it was really affecting on this rewatch.
Yeah. As someone that is now 42 years old, queer, and single, yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. It definitely does. But I think this movie, the way, what I love about it is the way that it ends up grouping a queer man, a mute woman, and a black woman together to pull off this heist for this creature that is looked at as other as well. Yeah. And so that's one thing that I think in general, not just with queerness, but just in the way Guillermo del Toro handles outsiders and people who are in the marginalized parts of society. Really, I find it really affecting in this movie, personally.
Me too. Like, talking about how these sort of outsiders are silenced and not heard, to the point of even having Elsa's neck wounds be, we think, the reason why she's mute. And then coming full circle at the end where they become her gills. Mm-hmm. I was a mess.
Yeah.
It was so affecting. God, is such a beautiful movie. And something that I was always kind of mad about, but also fascinated with, is there was such a positive response. People loved it so much. It was this historic genre win at the Oscars. I think it was the second movie, the second fantasy film ever to win Best Picture after the third Lord of the Rings film. And then after all of that, I think people got cool on it. Do you remember this happening not long after the Oscar sweep?
I don't, actually. No.
My perception is that people kind of turned on it, that it got too big too fast, and it was kind of like uncool to like it. And I always, yeah, that always kind of like stung me because I love it so much.
People are so fickle.
They're little bitches. Does it still hold up the same way, like, what, 5 years later?
Absolutely. I saw this in the movie theater. I saw it maybe once when it came out on Blu-ray or whatever, and then I have not revisited it since. So it's probably been 4 years since I've seen this. And yeah, it absolutely holds up for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that I think on a rewatch, I appreciate it a whole lot more too, just the intricate way the story unfolds.
Mm-hmm.
That maybe on my first watch, when I was just, you know, appreciating it for the joy that it was, I was missing out on. And I think that's why you mentioned earlier that you got a little misty-eyed from the very opening. And I think coming back to it and you realize what the story is about when you hear Richard Jenkins giving us this, once upon a time, yeah, it will bring you back to the end of the movie immediately. Ugh. And so I think on a rewatch, I can understand getting, you know, caught up in the moment with that because you know what's coming.
I was hysterical. I was like, I need to call my therapist. Something was wrong. Before we head into conclusion territories, I want to ask about how this film handled its sexuality, in your opinion. Because I remember that was like a big talking point when it came out, because there is some sort of vague interspecies, you know, sex in the film. And do you think it was handled like poetically, or was there an element of camp to it? Like, do you think it works?
Honestly, I wanted to see them go at it.
Because we see some like pretty, like there's masturbation in this film. They're not holding, yeah, back from that. There's nudity in the film. They're not holding back from that. I don't know if audiences would have been able to handle that though.
Actual Give sex. Us Gilman dick.
I know. Well, they talk about it pretty explicitly, or at least they like.
I love the hand gestures she makes for, yeah, it.
Well, I didn't remember if we saw it or not, because I guess I remembered the hand gestures, but I didn't remember that's how it was presented. I just kind of I had the information that that's how, but I didn't remember how I knew that. And I was like, okay, so she tells me. Interesting.
Yeah.
I actually just think it was like, even the sex for this in this film, and even the masturbation in this film, was just like kind of romantic and kind of wholesome and kind of nice.
As ridiculous, so you mentioned camp. As ridiculous as it is that she stuffs, you know, towels under her door and is able to fill up the
yeah. You gotta go with it.
As campy as that is, it does create in a very small microcosm, the shot that I think enticed young Guillermo del Toro from the very beginning of, you know, the woman floating and the creature floating underneath her. Like, we get that.
Yeah.
It's more vertical than horizontal, but like, yeah, it's still that kind of moment that I think he wanted to create. And I think this was probably the only way that he could do it within the confines of the story.
I think so too. But then you also get, even though they're nude, that moment of where Richard Jenkins comes in and they're just holding each other. Mm-hmm. And she's just so happy and he's happy for her. Oh, God. I'm happy for her.
I'm happy for her too. And but he's looking at like at least someone of us has found love.
Yeah.
And that's heartbreaking. This movie is fucking heartbreaking.
And he like risks it all because he doesn't believe it's going to happen for him. And honestly, 1962, like it wasn't.
No, it wasn't.
So he had to sacrifice so she could. And that's really nice. Even though now she's under the sea. I'm assuming.
Which, okay, you mentioned interspecies. I don't think it's interspecies. I think she is. I think she's a Gil woman.
She's Gil woman for sure. She's bride.
That was one thing that like all my coworkers would be like, "You saw that movie?" And I was like, "Yeah." And like, "Isn't that the monster fucking movie?" Like, yeah, actually.
Yeah. See, I think yeah, wrong it is. With that? Hey, well, that's how I feel that there's nothing wrong with it, but I you're right. He is humanoid and she is fishoid, but you know, there's a bridge between the two, and I'm okay with it.
I'm okay with it.
It's consensual.
Listen, this is you're talking to someone that was like, yeah, I would date the predator the fish from man? Prey.
Who from Prey?
The predator.
Oh, the predator from Prey. I was like, I guess that makes the most sense. I don't know if I would. I found the bone mask to be really gross. It was really icky. But I feel you. It was the hottest of all the predators. So yeah.
Yeah. Well, the guy that was playing him was hot too. Holy
I don't know
cow.
If I've ever seen what the guy looks like.
I'll send it to you once we're done with this. He's a very attractive man.
Okay, I'm excited to see. But that was a good movie too. And even though he is kind of an animal, he's intelligent enough to give consent, and so everything's fine.
Exactly.
Everything's fine. I guess on that note, Terry, where can you be found on the internet?
You can find me on Twitter, as long as it's still existing, at Gaily Dreadful, as well as on Instagram. And if you want to listen to us talk to people about a movie that traumatized them as a child, including host of this show, Josh Horngut, go listen to Scarred for Life at Scarred Podcast on Twitter as well.
Yeah. It's the best. Well, thank you for chatting with me today. Thank you so much for listening to Development Hell. If you enjoy this podcast, then please do us a major favor of leaving us 5 stars and writing a positive review. It really makes all the difference in the world. We'll see you next week with a brand new episode of Development Hell.
Thank you for listening to the Dread Podcast Network.